Chicago. This is Chris Roebling, substituting this evening for Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our prestigious panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast and border to border. This evening in our studio at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in downtown Chicago, we welcome Stephanie Hitt, Kitty Kurth, and Khalil Marar. Our toll-free phones are now open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. And you can even watch us on our website at www.beyondthebeltway.com. Good evening, everybody, and great to be back with all of you. Stephanie, Kitty, Khalil, big week in politics, a lot to talk about. Where to begin? You know,
I thought we were talking about the NCAA playoffs.
Yeah, how about that Michigan State win this afternoon? And as we speak, Gonzaga is probably, I don't know if Gonzaga is going to make it. Against Duke.
Because I just like saying Gonzaga.
I love the Zags. I love the Zags. And anybody listening in Eastern Washington, go Zags. That's what I say. I mean, those guys, they are really scrappy. So it's a great tournament so far, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, my alma mater, I'm pretty sure lost. So I'm really not paying attention.
My alma mater hasn't made it past the second round in probably a decade. That's Georgetown. But at least
University of Virginia did really well last year, and I was all psyched. And then, like, after we lose, I just lose interest.
And that's just because of some injuries. They'll come back. But I actually liked seeing a really strong Notre Dame for the first time in many decades. Yeah. And, I mean, it was close with Kentucky. I think, looking at the brackets, maybe Notre Dame should have been in a different region or something like that. That would have been a great Final Four to have Notre Dame in it. I felt like they earned it.
Has anyone anywhere, on this show we talk a lot about government accountability, transparency, openness. None of that applies to the NCAA. Do we know how they
do that? I don't know.
Actually,
it would be a fascinating documentary to figure out how they bracket and to like watch it going on.
You've got to get a guy with
behind the scenes.
Yeah, a pen camera wearing it in his pocket.
Exactly.
Wait a minute, say that again about Georgetown. All right.
I always thought that it was a lot of like slips of paper in a bowl and drawing out the slips of paper.
I think it is the subject of these ESPN 30 for 30s.
Sure is. Yeah.
And so I'm sure we could bone up on it. And not that we're getting off of politics, but as long as we're on the Kitty, you started, you're a bad influence.
As usual.
But I want to say ESPN 30 for 30s, if you haven't seen them, they're done at an extraordinarily high level. Have you seen any,
mm-hmm,
Khalil?
Mm-hmm.
They find some phenomenal sports stories.
They do, and I think that it's really interesting. I mean, I'm a sort of a cultural analyst by training, and really, it's not just the stories that they cover, but really the sort of like the relationship between sports and society. And one thing that really spoke to me is when you said, this organization that basically regulates the March Madness teams. Probably has more controversy surrounding it if we were digging than, say, FIFA in Europe. So, and really, it's something that ought to have transparency and yet doesn't. So it's quite remarkable in that respect.
That is Khalil Marar, and he's an assistant professor of political science at Governor State University in beautiful University Park, Illinois. And we welcome you to the program this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Especially because we're going to be talking a lot about international affairs. We've been chatting with Kitty Kurth, who is a internationally recognized communications and campaign strategist.
Yes, thank you, Chris. An old friend of Chris Roebling.
I cannot keep up with your travels. I would love to be your valise, just to go all the places that Kitty gets to go. And, of course, Stephanie Hitt, a longtime friend of the program, activist, Republican, also attorney, now living in Evanston, Illinois.
Right, and mother of four.
Oh, wow.
All who play sports.
Okay.
And so I'm a chauffeur extraordinaire, but... And so to go with Khalil, what Khalil was saying is sports isn't just a cultural phenomenon. It is one of the greatest ways of teaching life lessons.
Absolutely.
For kids. Yeah. And I love watching the sports stories because my kids, it's so easy to sort of relate them to things they're doing, you know, at school and at work or problems with friends. And just watching sports, just it covers life.
It does.
Sports mirrors life. And so those stories are phenomenal, even for people that aren't athletes. Yeah.
And sports and music are the greatest ways to start diplomacy.
Is that
the
right?
Greatest ways to get people talking. The cultural exchange programs that go on between the U.S. and countries all over the place. It's a great way to get people started talking to each other. You know, and when you start talking about football or soccer, depending. You can also argue because if you call it football or soccer.
Right.
But, you know, you start there, you start talking about jazz, and you can go anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Well, it's all part of the cultural richness that is America. And some of that cultural wealth in America is somehow sent over into the political realm. And that's what we're here to talk about tonight. So I just want to do – so we're kind of having a nice little slow start to the program. But we've got a lot. Harry Reid announced this week that his era in the U.S. Senate is going to end. That's something to talk about. We've got this Hillary Clinton thing about her wiping off all of the emails from her server. That's something to talk about. The Republicans passed a budget. Is that not – the Republicans passed a budget over in the House? That's important stuff.
Right. Well, and I was thinking of Republicans. I thought you were going to hint at Ted Cruz's announcement.
Ted Cruz announced this week.
Marco Rubio is about to announce.
Right.
Yeah.
And as we speak.
Carly Fiorina, yes.
And Carly Fiorina announced today that she's probably going to get in on the Republican side. And, of course, internationally, I think it's fair to say all eyes are, apart from the tragedy this week, which seems to have no real political dimension, the air tragedy with the German Wings plane crashing in France, all eyes are really on diplomacy with Iran and what choices are being made. Okay. That's just some of what we're talking about. Let me go around. Of that group, where do you want to begin after the first break?
Well, I can bridge us because I was reading just a couple minutes ago about how the Iran negotiations have actually been going better than negotiations have in the past because Iran's chief negotiator had lived here in the U.S. for 20 years. And he understood how we act and he understands, you know, when the Americans started talking to him by his first name, he wasn't taken aback as many Iranians would be because he's like, oh, they're Americans. Mm-hmm. Of course they're going to call me by my first name. Mm-hmm. But I think sometimes getting to know people in diplomatic and with sports, with music, with food, getting to know people as people before you get to know them politically can go a long way to moving the actual diplomacy along.
So you're voting to start with the Iranian.
Sure.
All right.
Get
Khalil.
The hard stuff out of the way first.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
I think Iran is a good starting place.
Right.
And it's
right.
going to be crucial, especially for the foreign policy of this nation in the coming presidential election.
Stephanie, what's your?
I actually would agree. I can't believe I'm agreeing with some Democrats
that's okay.
here. But
we promote
but
that.
Talking about the Middle East is very key, but I want to look quickly at 2016 as well.
We will not forget 2016. We're not going to forget. Don't forget us. 1-800-723-8289. Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. It's Beyond the Beltway. Welcome to the program, and we'll get underway just after these words.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City. At HiltonUniversal.com, they let you be the star in Hollywood.
It is Beyond the Beltway. Welcome back. Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont, taking a night off, and we will be seeing him next week back in this chair. Joining us, we've got, of course, Khalil Mirar, Kitty Kurth, Stephanie Hitt. We're starting off with Iran. So, okay, we want to know, everybody wants to know what is in the deal, and we're not seeing what's in the deal, and we could have a conversation about all of that. But I want to get to this sort of prior question, and I'm holding on to John Bolton. I'm going to get to Bolton in a second, but I'm holding on to this question right now about, wasn't it the case, didn't the administration originally say that in exchange for adhering to whatever is imposed in the agreement, Iran would experience a lifting of sanctions so that they perform and then are rewarded by the international community? And is it not the case that what we're hearing is Iran is making it non-negotiable that upon conclusion of the agreement, not adherence, not verification, not validation, but upon conclusion of the agreement, they insist on the sanctions being lifted? Would you be okay with sanctions being
Chris,
lifted?
This is why they call it negotiations. And just like when the vice president is picked on a national ticket, usually the people who know aren't talking and the people who are talking don't know. So I would say that most of what we're hearing about the negotiations before it's officially announced is probably a lot of BS.
You think so?
Yeah, Khalil, or obfuscation.
My question, Khalil, for you is...
And I have a two-part follow-up later after Khalil and Stephanie.
I'm on the edge of my bench right here. Khalil, would you accept or would you support an agreement that lifted sanctions for the mere arrival at an agreement as opposed to adherence to its tenets?
Look, I mean, it is, I agree with Kitty in this respect that it is negotiations, which means that everything is on the table. Now, if it is true what you were talking about earlier, and that is that sanctions will be lifted no matter what the outcome, I think that's a dangerous proposition indeed. And I don't think that is one that would be agreed to a wise administration. So I guess it's up to your viewers now to decide whether this is a wise administration. And we have to remember that, you know, and I've said it on this program with Bruce, I've said it with you being on the panel, that the best way out of Iraq is through Iran. The best way out of Baghdad is through Tehran. And what I've always meant by that is that we can't ultimately secure Iraq to a level of security that we want in the Middle East without bringing on the Iranians. I think the negotiations are a crucial stepping stone for that outcome, that the way out of Iraq is through Iran.
Stephanie?
Well, I think in one sense there is sort of a general agreement. If an agreement can be reached with Iran that does in fact thwart or delay significantly, like way out, any nuclear development, I think the Middle East would be happy with that. A lot of our allies would be happy with it. But those are a lot of big ifs. I think part of this talk about demanding immediate sanctions, so some of that is spin with negotiations when you're trying to get a deal. You also want to get people out there spinning things. You want to apply public pressure, appearances pressure. We see that all the time in
Absolutely.
Politics. They're very good at that. What I have heard, though, is that, and this is one of the very sticking points, how Kerry is handling it, I don't know, but that we are insisting on a phased out lifting of the sanctions. And again, that would only be determined by having verification, having UN access or whatever. And those are the key sticking points right now in the negotiations.
I just want to say our phone number is 1-800-723-8289, 1-800-723-8289. So if you want to participate in the conversation, we would love to hear from you. Whatever radio station you're listening on, or Sirius XM POTUS, or on the web, or on our new flagship station here in Chicago, very happy to be with WCGO 1590 on the AM dial here in Chicago. Okay, when did we as a country decide to make this shift from Saudi Arabia and the Sunnis to Iran and the Shias? When was that? When did we hear a big foreign policy speech from President Obama saying, I am going to alter 75 years of security architecture?
You haven't because it hasn't been done. We're talking to everybody. We're talking to everybody. And sometimes these are the kinds of subtleties that are lost when people don't pay close attention. As in your, Chris, I have to take you to task on your question and agree with Stephanie on her answer.
Oh, my gosh. This is unbelievable.
But, you know, they weren't. No, but you talked about what they were actually saying, phased in or phased out sanctions. They're not talking about 100% of this or 100% of that. And in all of our diplomacy, we're not talking about 100% of this or 100% of that. We haven't stopped talking to the Saudis. We're talking to the Saudis. We're working with the Saudis every day. But we're also talking to Iran, and one of the main reasons is for the very reason that you were talking about 8, maybe 10 years ago, I had a visit in my office here in Chicago from several Iraqi leaders, some sheikhs and some governors, and it was right at the time when the war was over, although I hate to say over because I don't think it's ever over. But they came to our office and we said, you know, well, how can we help? Well, you know, everybody wants to send over soldiers. And they said, we need investors. We don't need soldiers. We need investors. We need to rebuild our business. We need to rebuild our electricity. And guess what? On our border with Iran, the Iranians are rebuilding our electrical infrastructure. And in Baghdad, where the Americans are, the electrical structure is getting taken out every night. People in our biggest cities don't have electricity, but everybody on the Iranian border has electricity.
Okay.
Guess who we like better?
Okay. Khalil, have you witnessed a shift, notwithstanding Kitty's eloquence, have you witnessed a shift from Saudis to a concern about and a desire to engage with the Iranians?
Look, Chris, you make a great point. That is, this is undoing 75 years of American diplomacy in the region and the American approach to the region. You're absolutely right about that. But let's face it, 2003 was a watershed year. I mean, that was the year in which the United States toppled Saddam Hussein and took down the Ba'ath regime, took down basically the Sunni leaders of Iraq. And at the point that we do that, we have no other option by which to pursue peace in the region without looking to Iran in some way, shape, or form. But I share your concern about this. And not only do I share your concern, I think that we have to be very careful. We're playing with fire here, right? And if we don't get it right, the options are very limited.
Let's talk about how dangerous this is. On the one hand, we have seen, and all politics aside, Kitty, I mean, this is not, I'm not scoring points here, but
absolutely.
Yemen has, in a very serious way, disintegrated.
Yeah.
Okay. It's impossible not to say that Yemen has disintegrated. And as it has disintegrated, a lot of different derivatives of that. Okay. But it implicates peace and stability on the Arabian Peninsula.
Yes.
Right. And Kitty was sort of discussing this change in policy is a nuanced change. There are many who say, well, this is more of a haphazard kind of change, and it's a reactionary change. And so I think one of the disturbing things that has come out in the last few days is the fact that Saudi Arabia, an ally who does have military ties with the U.S., who was able to go in Yemen and gave the U.S. only had 1 hour's notice before they went in and conducted airstrikes. So all of a sudden, our allies are acting without us.
Yeah, but
so where are we in all of that as well? I mean, there are a lot of things that are coming out that are suggesting that we are not as in control of the nuances of this shift as we...
I think you guys are missing the point. I think it wasn't all of a sudden. I think over the last 10 years, Saudi Arabia has not stepped up to the plate and has not been our ally. And that's what we've seen consistently in the spread of terrorism and the spread of ISIS. And Saudi Arabia hasn't been there for us.
Well, I don't know how... I don't know how Iran suddenly became our friend. I mean, I missed that.
Maybe
I missed that press conference as well.
Maybe we're trying to. Politics makes strange bedfellows, and as I said about the Iran-Iraq border, we've got to try and make friends there because right now
I understand.
They hate us in the region more than anything, and we've got to find friends wherever we can.
I, I was there in November. I'm going back next month, and I'm not so sure about, quote, hate. I think there is a lot of desire. I mean, we're who we are, they're who they are, and we've been the cement in this security architecture. But I want to ask you, Kitty, when you say that about Saudi Arabia, is that the same analysis that the Obama administration applies to Israel?
I have no idea. I'm not in the State Department.
Okay. But, I mean, do you think that we're as close to Israel right now as we should be?
No, but I think it takes two to tango. I think Bibi Netanyahu has done everything in his power politically and optics-wise to separate himself from Obama and to insult President Obama. And I think it takes two to tango.
Well, I would disagree. I would feel, if anything,
coming to the United States and talking in Congress in an unprecedented way isn't insulting. Please.
And I think, and interfering in Israel's elections against Netanyahu is also interfering.
By having him come
I think
over.
That, you know,
no, wait. Hold on 1 second. 300 Obama campaign operatives or volunteers were shipped over to Israel to defeat Bibi Netanyahu.
And how many people from the RNC were there working on his behalf?
Maybe
a
half
500,
a dozen?
Maybe 1,000?
Oh, I have.
What I heard.
And at the bottom line is Netanyahu represents Israel, and Israel's fighting for its life right now.
Well, and we'll have more to talk about Israel and Saudi Arabia and our allies and our adversaries in the Middle East after these words. It's Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. The program is Beyond the Beltway, and we'll see you in a few minutes.
Sick of wading through social media, papers, and nightly news to get your Chicago political scoop? Subscribe to AlderTrack instead. It's got a weekday newsletter with original reporting on all 50 aldermen, top city agencies, administrative commissions, their staff, and more. It's my go-to source for news, raw data, and council tidbits first thing in the morning. If you subscribe to AlderTrack.com before April 7th, you'll get 10% off. Get AlderTrack now, or you'll be missing out when the new council begins.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for the new Wild Travels series Saturdays at 5:30 and Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
Beyond the Beltway, and I'm Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Thanks for tuning in wherever you are. A lot of people watching us on the internet tonight. A lot of people are listening to us on Sirius XM POTUS, and we love that. We're on radio stations from coast to coast, including here in Chicago, WCGO. So if you're on radio, that's great. And we want to hear from you. Our phone number, 800-723-8289, 800-723-8289. All right, so we're talking about international relations, and we're talking about the Gulf, and we're talking about our allies. And, we've got the excuse me, the Gulf Cooperation Council, a set of allies. And Kitty has made the point that the Saudis have not been good allies in the last 10 years.
As good as they could be.
Okay.
As good as they could be. They haven't been overly helpful in the war on terrorism.
Khalil.
And the spread of Wahhabism.
Khalil, how well... Where do you come out on the U.S. and its allies in the region? Let's just talk about the GCC for now, the Gulf Cooperation Council. Yeah. Are we being a good friend? Are they being good allies? Are they doing things to advance terrorism behind our back? Are we doing things behind their
advance.
Back?
I said not fight.
Okay, not fight.
Yeah. I mean, look.
There's a big difference.
It's a well-known open secret, if you will, that for the longest time that some members of the GCC, especially Saudi Arabia and Qatar and elsewhere, have actually been supporting Islamist groups around the region. And the one primary reason that they've been supporting them is because in 2011 we had the Syrian uprising against Assad. The natural allies against Assad's regime have been the Islamist factions that now basically have pulled together to call themselves ISIS. But we have to be careful because before that, our allies were actually doing our bidding by supporting the Mujahideen in much the same way that we supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. It's much more analogous to Afghanistan during the 1970s than it is to anything else that I've studied in the past.
Can you give us your perspective on the practical, as we read the newspapers tomorrow morning, the significance of the Sunni-Shia split and how that is animating, say, events in Yemen.
That's a great question, Chris. It wasn't always that way, but recently the Sunni-Shiite split, the divide between Sunnis and Shiites, has animated politics in the region like nothing else. I mean, look at what's going on right now, right? Tomorrow you might read headlines about how Saudi Arabia is furthering its campaign in Yemen. And what you will notice is that Saudi Arabia is being joined by its Sunni allies, right? Countries like Jordan, countries like Oman and elsewhere are basically joining the Saudis precisely because they're much more afraid of Iran in the region than any other time in history. And there is good reason to be afraid of Iran. That is that Iran has been rather expansionist and has been causing trouble for the Sunni regimes, whether it's in Lebanon with Hezbollah, whether it's Hamas in Gaza, whether it's the, you know, the sort of like factions that have been operating against, to destabilize, if you will, the Sunni establishment in Iraq. I mean, there's been a lot of things that Iran has been doing to throw its weight around the Middle East. The best way to check it back is to basically rally the Sunnis around a common platform. And the common platform now is that we need to stop Iran at all costs.
And now, okay, with that common platform, could you then take this additional step? And then we're going to get back to Kitty and Stephanie. But could you take this additional step into how the GCC crowd is relating, say, to Israel?
They're on the same side when it comes to Iran. I'm not sure that anything else they would see eye to eye. Like, for example, you have the Israeli-Palestinian conflict where the GCC and the Arab League has repeatedly told Israel, look, settle your problems with the Palestinians and we can actually have an alliance together against our enemies, common enemies in the region. And that's the one sticking point, if you will, that really is key to making sure that Israel and the GCC and the Arab League are much more likely to be on the same side, especially vis-a-vis Iran, than otherwise would be the case.
Stephanie, what is your anticipated situation in the Middle East, say in the spring or in the summer of 2016, when the presidency will be hotly contested, presumably by Hillary Clinton on behalf of the Democrats, although I personally don't think it'll be her, but Hillary is said to be the one to get that nomination, and somebody from the Republican side.
Well, I think what's going to be interesting is right now, what the Republicans have not really stepped forward yet, but they will probably come out in some way to actually define what is the Middle East conflict. Right now, it's very hard, and our administration hasn't really led us to understand what are we defining as the Middle East conflict. Is it Sunni versus Shiite? Is it Sunni Shiite sects as they operate in different countries? Is it whoever we need to bond with to fight ISIS? Is it everyone we need to bond with to fight Iran? So we've got Sunni Shiite with their division, but yet we have yet to come up with a plan or a policy that shows where we stand with respect to Iran and sometimes with ISIS. One common fact seems to be we'll sort of go with whoever we need to fight ISIS, and that's a relatively new approach. And if that means we partner with Iran, as we are doing in Tikrit, it looks like, then it's confusing. So I think one of the things that an emerging leader will need to do is be able to grasp what the nuances are in those, to be able to define what the conflicts are, and to actually know what is in our best interest.
Kitty, I'm coming to you. Hold on one second. I'm coming to you.
What she's defined is pretty much it. Well, those are all the problems.
But Kitty, right? I want to say, what will Hillary say on her own behalf if the conflicts that we've been seeing sort of continue to grow between now and, since we're not looking at the ISIS thing being resolved?
I have no idea. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know.
But you're a Democrat activist. Yeah, you support Hillary. What is she going to say?
I do.
As a quad Democrat.
Democrat.
If she's the nominee.
Last I checked, I don't know who's running for 2016, and I'm not supporting anyone.
So you think Hillary might not be running?
I have said that for 3 years. Until she says she's running, I don't know that she's running.
Do you think that she has a weakness?
No, it is so not a head feeling, Chris. It's absolutely a political gut feeling. I just haven't been convinced that she's running. And it's I apologize, but it is not anything I've read, heard.
It's right, right. It's not your inside info.
It's my political
Because
political
we should tell people.
It's my political gut feeling.
We should tell people that you do hang out with people at pretty high levels.
Well, I spend a lot of time traveling with Vice President Biden.
That might be considered to be a high level. I mean, I would say the Vice President is
and
a high level.
The President used to be my volunteer back in the day.
And so you're known to these people. All right. So let me add this.
I don't have, you know,
I understand. You're not
late
you're not,
night conversations.
Right. But now, okay. So we talked about 2016. Now let's add the Israel situation. And this very difficult relationship that we're in.
I think
how will that affect Republicans and how will that affect Democrats?
I think Stephanie actually laid it out very well in that these are shifting sands. And, you know, Khalil gave us the historic background. But to try to say what it's going to look like a year from now, that's way above my pay grade. But, you know, even with ISIS, we didn't have we weren't trying to have a relationship with Iran vis-a-vis ISIS a year ago, because vis-a-vis ISIS a year ago, it didn't exist the way it does now. You know, this is a new, ever-changing situation. And, you know, I might be able to predict what's going to happen in Iowa a year from now, but I can't predict what's going to happen in Iran and Iraq a year
And I
from
think
now.
we're going to be looking for a leader, probably from the Republicans, someone who does understand the Middle East. And I think the fear and I think the weakness for Hillary right now, and it likens right back to some words she said that will come back to bite her, and that is, what difference does this make? And that is, what happened in Libya? And is that just an example of not knowing what's really going on and not being able to handle that situation? Now look at Libya. Is she the kind of leader that's not going to be aware and involved with every detail that you need to know to be able to manage the Middle East?
Khalil, you're the professor of political science. How do you think the Middle East will play into presidential politics?
I think it'll play largely. And one of the crucial questions that the American people are asking themselves right now, ourselves right now, is whether we're going to have a continued presence in the region the way that we have since, say, 2003, boots on the ground and all, or whether we're going to have a situation in which we can tend to our own house. And you know, the Democrats, as well-meaning as they might be, are going to be making arguments like, well, we need to tend to our own house first and foremost instead of looking abroad, sending troops abroad, and so on and so forth. But I also fear that the Republicans have sort of played their hand with what happened in Iraq to such an extent that nobody's going to be taking the warnings, the dire warnings about Middle Eastern politics seriously, especially of our Republican presidential candidate that says we need to go back there. I fear that it's a different political terrain right now. The American appetite for re-engagement with the Middle East, especially with boots on the ground, is one that is rather subdued. And the only support that you have is for limited airstrikes against immediate adversaries like ISIS.
Let me ask you a question. Is that because we have, and all politics aside, I mean, it's obvious, we have a president and a White House and an administration that does not, for whatever reason, right, wrong, good, bad, political or not, whatever, it is their decision not to explain the situation over there in a way that would, say, create a base of support for, say, more aggressive military, not talking about sending over the 101st Airborne, not talking about a massive deployment like under Bush.
You know,
and I'm not seeking this, but
Chris, I think knowing the president in a tiny way that I used to and watching him now, he's a guy that wants to have some answers before he goes out and stands and talks in front of the American people. And they're talking. The diplomatic process is working. The State Department is doing their job. The NSC is doing their job. Everybody's collecting information. They're not going to go off and get boots on the ground in a half-baked situation.
That's Kitty Kurth. She's joined this evening by Stephanie Hitt and by Khalil Mahrar. I'm Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. And we're glad you're here. We'll be back after these words.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a 4-diamond hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, City Walk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City. At HiltonUniversal.com, they let you be the star in Hollywood.
Sunday night means Beyond the Beltway. My name is Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us. Our phone number is 800-723-8289, and we've got a caller, or we had a caller. I was just going to go to that caller, and they wiped him out. So there you go. We had a nice caller from Lebanon, New Hampshire, who was going to ask us about Israel. And we could have asked him about New Hampshire. We could have said, hey, enough about international affairs.
No.
All right, so let's talk here in this last segment of the first hour. Let's talk a little bit about the presidential, sort of the two top presidential stories, I guess. And that would really be Ted Cruz and I think Hillary Clinton and her server. Ted Cruz announced this week he's been in the Senate about as long as Obama had been in the Senate, and he's announced for president. What do we? The press absolutely went bananas with this, and the liberals went bananas about it. Kitty, you're a liberal.
Yes.
Ted Cruz cause you to go bananas?
No, I think he's a really smart guy who has positions that are really different than mine.
Right.
But that's why we have elections.
Right.
So we can talk about ideas.
Yeah.
I didn't like that they made kids come and get fined if they didn't come.
But that's a big policy at that school.
Yeah. But then that's only because as an advanced person, I know how hard we normally work to fill those places.
No,
and we were all like, wait, why didn't we think of it? And B, isn't that kind of cheating?
Yeah.
No, I thought, you know, he's a very good speaker. He's clearly a smart guy.
Yeah.
Everybody that knew him at Harvard is not surprised by him
wanting to run for president.
I would caution that he hasn't done a great job of working and playing well with others in the Senate, which maybe doesn't hurt him in the Senate, but when you go around the country and try to get people to endorse you, it could be problematic.
Khalil?
You know, I feel very uncomfortable talking about the political tea leaves, but that's exactly what they are, is tea leaves. I mean, the election last time I checked is November 2016, so we have to be very cautious about who the candidates are going to be or who they're not going to be. But I think the issues that you're talking about and that we're discussing here are very important. And so far, if the Republican establishment is basically pinning their hopes on, you know, repeal, 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 and whether it's, you know, Obamacare or foreign policy or negotiations with Iran, they're going to have a really tough fight with whoever the Democratic candidate is. And the reason they're going to have a tough fight is because when you oppose something, from my study of history and political science, you're much less likely to get your way than when you're actually for something. I think the Republicans, if I can give them a little bit of advice, and I'm neither Republican nor Democrat, I would give both sides this piece of advice, and that is that, you know, don't pin your hopes on what should be done away with. Don't pin your hopes on what should be canceled. Pin your hopes on proactive solutions. What should be done? Mm-hmm. How should we engage Iran? How should we engage the Middle East? How should we engage our allies, our enemies, friends and foes alike? And how should we engage the issues in this country? I think that's what 2016 should be about, even though I fear that the pundits and the political candidates themselves will not turn it into that.
Stephanie.
Well, you know, Ted Cruz is sort of an interesting candidate in that he doesn't have a lot of friends in the Senate, but that actually, for a lot of Americans, could be a plus.
Right.
There is the thought that he's kind of an outsider, and he's fighting the establishment. And if you look at approval ratings, and you look at the approval ratings of Congress and our government, they're at a historical lows. And so, if in fact you are the outsider and you're against the establishment, then that's actually going to be a plus for the people who actually vote.
But I think my question about the Cruz thing is this, and I've had the privilege of meeting him. We had lunch, and he's a remarkable individual. There's no two ways about it. He's a brilliant guy, and really knows what he's talking about. especially in the sort of constitutional law area.
And didn't he start studying constitutional law when he was literally 12?
Yes, and that's because he was in some kind of
debate group
or something, right. and back in Texas. But be all that as it may.
No, but that's cool.
I think it's very interesting. Cool. He's a fascinating person. He's got a lot to commend him, and he wouldn't be where he is today if he didn't have something going on.
Yes.
Okay, all of that said, is this a year in which you think Republicans are actually tending towards governors and not towards legislators?
Yes, I actually think that's a remarkable. We've seen legislators. I think there's a feeling that because of Obama's lack of experience, because of his difficulties in actually getting things done, that people want to see people with accomplishments. And I think this is going to be a big time for governors that... I'm tipping my hat here. No. I think we're going to see a real emergence of someone like Scott Walker, for example, someone who has worked in very hostile climates and can do the positive, as Khalil was saying, someone who can offer solutions, opportunities, potential.
But governors historically have had even bigger problems than Obama with Congress because they're used to being able to get things done. And unfortunately, being a president is not the same kind of executive position that being a governor is. And governors get really frustrated, and usually they don't have such a good relationship with...
Are you talking about Ronald Reagan? I remember Ronald Reagan getting a lot done
George
in Washington.
Bush. Tip O'Neill. And that's another interesting...
Reagan
had an amazing relationship.
Yeah. But that's what I would posit we need again is Democrats and Republicans who can actually speak to one another.
Right.
And Walker, I think, would have a hard time with that. But I think there are other... But you guys like nominating governors. Republicans often nominate governors.
Accomplishment.
Well, I think that Cruz has something of a handicap. If he stands up next to John Kasich or Scott Walker.
Well, and Kasich, for example, who also was in Congress before.
Yeah, Kasich has got a lot of strength.
He knows how to talk to everybody.
It's Kitty Kurth, Khalil Marar, Stephanie Hitt. I'm Chris Roebling, and the program is Beyond the Beltway. I'm here for Bruce Dumont. He'll be back next week. We're glad you're here this week, and we hope you'll stay over the next few minutes, and we will be back to chat with you then.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for the new Wild Travels series Saturdays at 5:30 and Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
Sick of wading through social media, papers, and nightly news to get your Chicago political scoop? Subscribe to AlderTrack instead. It's got a weekday newsletter with original reporting on all 50 aldermen, top city agencies, administrative commissions, their staff, and more. It's my go-to source for news, raw data, and council tidbits first thing in the morning. If you subscribe to AlderTrack.com before April 7th, you'll get 10% off. Get AlderTrack now, or you'll be missing out when the new council begins.
Live from Chicago, this is Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont for a second hour of Beyond the Beltway. We're coming to you from our radio home at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street here in downtown Chicago. Joining us tonight, Professor Khalil Marar, and that's Professor Khalil Marar right there on the right. And to his left is Kitty Kurth, and then, of course, Stephanie Hit. Thank you. One, thank you all for coming on the program tonight. So first hour was dominated by the situation in the Middle East and then a little bit about Ted Cruz. Let's jump into presidential politics on the Democratic side and Hillary Clinton. I mean, we've got this Hillary issue. It's all about these emails and did she save the emails and did she turn over the emails? And this week we learned, Stephanie, that she has turned over and her legal team says that she has cleaned off the server. So Richard Nixon never destroyed the tapes, but right. Hillary has erased the emails.
Well, and we're
and you're
asked
a former federal prosecutor.
Well, and Hillary and I, you know, share an alma mater, so I know where she's coming from sometimes. So,
okay.
But the interesting thing is, we are being asked. The American public is asked to trust that she appropriately sifted through personal versus work emails.
Thousands.
600,000 pages or something. And we're supposed to trust that she did the right thing and that she appropriately took out the wedding and yoga and bill emails, and that's all that she deleted. And that's what we're being asked to do, is to trust that she alone, sort of the fox in the hen house,
one second.
Took care of these emails.
Can I ask you about spoilation? What is spoilation and why is it significant?
What is spoilation?
Spoilation of evidence.
Well, yes.
It's a first cousin to obstruction of justice. May even be a sibling.
And that, I think that's really gets to the crux of it.
Thank you.
And that's the heart of it.
You guys are going to be so disappointed.
We will never know if there was something there about Benghazi or anything else.
Actually, you will. You guys are going to be really, really disappointed. But the rules for the federal government and for the State Department are, if you're not using a official email, that someone on the email chain has to have an official email for every email that's sent out. So all a good reporter has to do is go to state.gov and FOIA any of her emails that have her in the email chain, and all the emailers right there.
I want to know why, if that's so easily stated here in this program, those emails haven't been turned over to congressional investigators.
I have no clue. And it could have made it.
I want to ask you to tell the truth. If a Republican was pulling one-tenth of this, what would you be saying on this program?
It makes me crazy, Chris. It makes me crazy because she is dying a death by a thousand cuts, where if anybody had just, like, said plainly what, you know, when I – and maybe state has some different policy than the other arms of federal government, but I'm pretty sure they don't. From what I hear from my friends who work there, they don't. So can I just finish and restate clearly? So every email that she's sent that has to do with any of those topics, all a good reporter, and I'm reaching out to my good reporter friends, just FOIA and ask for anything with her email address in it.
Okay.
And you've got them all right there.
Everyone who's gotten an email from Hillary, please turn it over.
Yeah,
No. It's easier than that.
No, wait a minute.
Any email she sent for her job.
Obviously, you said this three times now.
But you guys aren't listening because she just said the wrong thing. It's any email chain that's about her job. Somebody from state has to also be CC'd on it.
Well,
when I go to search my email records, I can look for all the emails that have Stephanie hidden in it.
We understand.
Okay. All they have to do is she CC'd someone in the State Department on all her work emails.
You're forced to. That's the law.
Okay.
That's
the
rule.
We will trust that she did that.
But we don't know. We're not trusting that we did it because
we
know.
Why doesn't State just turn it over?
Kitty, just hold on 1 second. We are not trusting that she did that for the simple reason that we now know that many of Hillary's closest aides had their own personal emails. So what we have here is a situation in which, first of all, we can't be sure that she copied the State Department on all of her emails because those emails are not there, and it's impossible then
actually,
to get an isomorphic list
from
the State
Department.
You're
still not hearing me.
I am
they
hearing
are there.
You.
There. And all you have to do to get that list is to sort, to
if,
go to state
if she,
and sort with her email address.
If she sent,
they're all there.
Well, we don't know that they're... You're saying that if all of the regulations were followed, which she already hasn't followed the regulations, then there wouldn't be a problem if we just accept
you're
the burden of doing her
You're saying she's going to ever do something without her assistant being copied on it? How is it ever going to get done?
I think we're having a conversation that the American public took steps to never have to have. Okay, we're not supposed to have this conversation because she's supposed to follow the rules in the same place.
Which are now in place, which were not in place for her or Condoleezza Rice or Colin Powell. And now we have a rule. And it should have probably been done in 1992 as soon as people started using emails. But it wasn't.
But I don't think what I think what is probably going to bring her to a decision not to run for president, apart from criminal liability, is the fact that if you are the Secretary of State and you are receiving information about international affairs, then you are almost by its nature receiving classified information.
No classified information is sent via email ever by the State Department. None whatsoever.
Okay, that's one of those clear, bright line statements that hasn't been made by a lot of people in positions to make
It was made by Hillary
that.
Clinton.
Okay.
It's been made by the State Department. It was made by Josh Earnest. Chris, you've worked with the State Department over
the years.
Yes,
I have, and I've seen a lot of classified emails floating around.
There is no such thing as a classified email. If it goes by email, it is therefore not classified.
You know, I think what we are talking about here, though, Kitty, is also this issue of her closest aides having personal emails so that she could have been communicating with them from her personal email outside of the whole government context.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because we're arguing about who should have been CC'd on these emails, who's keeping them, whatever. At the end of the day, politics is also perception. And the bottom line is that we have just another instance of a Clinton, Hillary this time, as in other times, of not really coming forward right away with the truth. I mean
absolutely.
And
absolutely.
This is a huge
She took enormous
problem.
Steps to avoid coming forward with
exactly.
The
truth. And in fact, this email situation is after dribs and drabs of fighting on Benghazi. So we are looking at, you know, months and months of her, you know, obfuscating the process. And so that at the crux of it is, why do the rules not apply to her? Why is it different? And that is the perception. And
it's
that,
perception. And it's perception versus reality.
And unfortunately,
but in politics,
there are a lot of things that add up to that perception.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it so easily could have been avoided. That's the frustrating part
and
for
why,
people
so
who
if it was,
like her and
why
support
not?
Her.
Why wasn't
because
this avoided?
It's the way the Clintons do business. And it's immensely frustrating.
And I don't think people
well,
like
yeah,
it.
Why do they do business that way? What are they hiding?
Nothing. Nothing, but so, they don't like, but, you know.
They don't want us to know that they have nothing
emails.
To hide.
You know, it's
so
kind
they
of
they act like they have something
yeah.
to hide
and
because
think,
they have nothing to hide.
No, but I think, unfortunately.
Let's make them president.
The yoga emails,
but
to
bringing
be
it all back locally, all right. I think it's, I think, unfortunately, Rahm Emanuel has inherited that same
yeah.
mindset.
Oh, well.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
It's Beyond the Beltway, and I'm Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont tonight. Thanks for joining us. Our conversation going all over the internet through BeyondTheBeltway.com. We're on Sirius XM POTUS, and we're on maybe 30, 40 radio stations from coast to coast and border to border. So we're having a conversation about Hillary and 2016 and presidential politics. Khalil Mirar, you're the political scientist at the table. What do you think is going to be the significance, say, 12 months from now, of this Hillary email issue?
You know, there are overwhelming predictions and underwhelming predictions. And I'll make an underwhelming prediction, and it's this. And the proof is in the pudding. This is not going to be the story about Hillary Clinton in 2016 if she chooses to run. I think this is a story that is largely inflamed by the media. I think this is a story that really is media to media outlet. I think this is a story that the American people, and take Stephanie's sort of idea that politics is largely about perception, that the American people, frankly, don't care about, not just yet. Now, if there is evidence to the contrary, right, if there is evidence that shows that there is criminal wrongdoing or some sort of, you know, malfeasance or some sort of a malicious intent on Hillary Secretary Clinton's part, then I could totally see the sort of issues coming out of the woodwork. But right now, it really is an abstract story. It's he said, she said. It's a story of perception. It's a story about servers. Too abstract, if you will, for the average voter to sort of sink their teeth into. That's my prediction about
this.
Let
me ask this about
underlying tougher problem that Stephanie rightly put her her finger on is the Clintons do have, and many of the people who work for them have this kind of notion that there's one set of rules for them and there's one set of rules for everybody else. And it's really, really hard to run for president when you act that way. They didn't early on, like when Bill ran the first time in 1992 and even in 1996, they didn't. But over the years, I think it's grown and grown. And, you know, especially on the Democratic side, you can't act like you're above it or, you know, you have to be a person of the people.
That gets me, because Hillary is at this moment the dominant figure in the 2016 race, Republican and Democrat thrown in together. Let me ask you this, Kitty, and then let's all react. What three lessons do you think she's learned from her last race? What three changes will she make in how she prepares her campaign or organizes her campaign or executes her campaign?
That's a really good question, Chris. And there's three that I would hope she learns.
Yeah, let's have those.
I don't know if she has, but I would hope she has.
Okay.
And I also want to say that Khalil is kind of right. You know, if she's at 80% of Democrats liking her, clearly none of the people who she's asking to vote for could care less about her email.
Right.
Having said that, I would hope that she's learned, and this is just because I'm a lover of democracy, I would hope that she's learned to listen to people more than talk to people. I would hope that she has learned to run the race that's that week. You know, we had heard a lot of the time last time they were in Iowa, and they were already assuming that they had won the primary and looking towards something happening 6 months from then and not concentrating on the caucuses and what was going on that week. And I would hope she learned a little bit of what she learned in New Hampshire, a little bit of humility, and don't be afraid to let people know she's human. I think that's what people like the most about her, is that she's human. But she, like many politicians, goes a long way to pulling that back and hiding it.
Mm. Stephanie?
Well, it's interesting. You sort of hinted at something I would like to see her learn, and that is, and I'd like sort of almost any leader, we've seen this a little bit with Rahm Emanuel in Chicago, and that is, you know what? If you're tough or you've done something, own it.
Yeah.
Don't try to hide it or disguise it. I think we may never know what really happened to Benghazi and the decisions that she made as a Secretary of State, because I think in some ways she's too concerned about how it will appear.
The optics.
And will she exactly?
Right. Yeah.
And at the end of the day, when we have leaders that have to stand up to people like Putin, and to stand up, you know, to allies and foes in the Middle East, at the end of the day, they don't necessarily have to be the most likable person, but they have to show competence, direction, focus, and principle. And we're not seeing that from Hillary. And a lot of times we get stories giving us another version of maybe what happened.
Okay. All right. Are we seeing that from any Republicans?
I think that being a politician, I really don't begrudge this to any politician nowadays. Being a politician is very, very tough business. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm no fan of politicians. But I will say that one of the biggest weaknesses, I think, that we've seen in our democracy lately is that there's too much concentration on optics and not enough on substance. And I would fault the Clintons for that. And as much as I would fault everybody who's a politician out there for being too concerned, too obsessed almost, especially in this day and age of Twitter and Facebook and 24-hour news cycles, right? No. That there's too much concentration, too much focus, too much obsession. It really is an obsession, Chris, on optics and not enough on substance.
Okay, but
too much obsession with perception and not enough on character.
Okay. I don't disagree with that, but I asked you about Republicans. And for instance, I mean, on the Republican side, you don't have to be for him or against him.
Yeah.
Scott Walker really walked a substance line. Now, it's stuff that Kitty's friends might not like or union member, public
as
employee
a,
union
as
members.
As a part-time Wisconsin resident, I'm not really big on some of them.
Okay,
things,
that's
but.
Fine.
Yeah.
But the point is, I think we can acknowledge that these governors, whether they're O'Malley, look who's the understudy to Hillary Clinton, a former governor. Martin O'Malley of Maryland. And so these governors are actually having to put up or shut
Jeb
up.
Jeb Bush.
You make an excellent point, but we have to remember that both sides are playing this. And I think that Scott Walker was much more into the optics of sticking it to the Democrats, sticking it to the unions, that, listen to me very carefully, that the policy was almost led much more by the optics than the optics by the policy. Here's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that for a rising Republican star to alienate unionists, to alienate people who want a minimum wage, to alienate people who want good paying jobs, to alienate those that work in the public sectors who are doing an honorable, noble job. Now, granted, they're doing it in a way that's very much, and capriciously, I would say, underappreciated. He was much more into showing that he's into sticking it to the public sector unions than he was about what is the best policy for Wisconsin. And I fear that he would suffer the same fate in terms of what is the best policy for the United States of America.
Well, I kind of read that.
Hold on.
Kind
we
of
got another,
the opposite.
Let's
and
hear.
That is that he didn't care about the politics. He wanted to make the right decisions, tough decisions. It is tough to stand up against unions because you do take incredible political risk
it's
in
not
doing
tough
it.
Anymore.
But he stood
Stephanie,
and he did
anymore.
That.
It was
but
tough
he
for
stood
no, wait a minute. No,
at
wait a minute.
Three
public
different elections.
Jobs
in
he had to go through three elections to do it. You do not do that for optics if you subject yourself for three elections.
He refused a railroad company coming into Wisconsin that was going to build jobs and have 250 union jobs because he didn't want 250
No, that's not
–
that is, of
jobs.
Course, entirely wrong. That's
no,
not
that's
why he
not
said
– entirely
It is
wrong.
Entirely wrong, and here's why he said no. Because it was publicly subsidized and it wasn't going to be real and he didn't want to make the commitment.
It was very real and he also said no to the high-speed – the federal
high-speed rail
proven money
losers. Which he could have
had. I mean, look, I want to say it's not just Scott Walker.
All over Europe. It's
not,
proven money leaders.
You're right.
We don't want to be –
No.
Be internationally competitive.
It's not just Scott Walker. You're right about that.
Wait, I'm a train guy. You know that. I'm a transit guy, and that thing was a boondoggle and is a boondoggle, and the one in California is a boondoggle. Just because it works, there's a different history of the evolution of transportation technology in Europe from here. That's another story. I want to get on this, though.
Yeah.
It wasn't – first of all, I disagree with you 100%. I think
Fair
if
enough.
You go back and you look at the history of this, Walker arrived at a conclusion about what had to be done. Looking at the clock here, Walker had a conclusion about what had to be done, and he then decided to execute it come heck or high water.
Yeah.
I don't think he was gratuitously getting himself into these you know, sit-ins and everything else at the Capitol. But number
two, sure he was what he said to his donor from the Uline Corporation on tape. He said before he ever my number one goal is to break the unions. Just watch me. Everybody around the country is going to see it.
Exactly. And
that's
it. And that's it. And that's no. That is substance, because the unions are bankrupting the city of Chicago, where we have $19,000 per individual. Every little kid you see on the street in Chicago, $19,000.
We, the governments over all these years, the union members all paid in their portions of their pay. It was the successive administration.
No, wait a second. Wait.
Don't blame the unions.
I'm blaming
the
unions. No. Hold on a second. I'm blaming the unions, Kitty, because they
do your math, Chris.
Because they took the public taxpayer dollars and they converted that into union dues, and then they gave it to Democratic politicians who then went and filled those positions and didn't fund the pensions. So they are entirely responsible. But my Democratic counterexample to Scott Walker is, of course, the Democrat Gina Raimondo. Raimondo went out, when she's treasurer in Rhode Island, she says the same things that Walker said. And she said, I'm not going to approve this. I'm not going to sign another official statement, because this system is absolutely collapsing all around us. And who took off after her? The unions did.
Look, there's a bigger
point. And now
she's
governor. She got promoted.
There's a bigger point here. At Governor State University, we say bigger ideas, right? And the bigger idea that's taking place here is that you have a poison that is afflicting this nation's politics.
Union money.
Poison. Listen to me very carefully.
Union
very
money.
Public employee.
I'm not
partisan,
good.
Right?
It's like the Soros money.
That's okay.
That's precisely the point, right? Is that we have too much in the way of the, you know, Soros brothers, Koch brothers, or rather Soros and Koch brothers, too much money that is playing a role in this country's political system that is poisoning the outcome. And we also have to be aware, that the more partisan we become, the more poisoned we become.
And that was Khalil Mirar from Governor State University in beautiful University Park, Illinois. And this is Beyond the Beltway. And I'm Chris Roebling, and I'm here for Bruce Dumont. He'll be back next week. We hope you'll be back in just a few minutes. Thank you.
Sick of wading through social media, papers, and nightly news to get your Chicago political scoop? Subscribe to AlderTrack instead. It's got a weekday newsletter with original reporting on all 50 aldermen, top city agencies, administrative commissions, their staff, and more. It's my go-to source for news, raw data, and council tidbits first thing in the morning. If you subscribe to AlderTrack.com before April 7th, you'll get 10% off. Get AlderTrack now, or you'll be missing out when the new council begins.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for the new Wild Travels series Saturdays at 5:30 and Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
Beyond the Beltway Sunday night, my name is Chris Roebling, sitting in for your friend Bruce Dumont, who will be back next week, and joined by an all-star panel, Stephanie Hitt, longtime friend of the program. You've been on many times in the last few years. Quite a few years now. Over here, let's go to Khalil Mirar. Okay, that's me. And Khalil Mirar, he's right here. The camera's getting on to Khalil Mirar, and there he is. Much better looking guy. Anyway, Khalil, we're going to get, there you go. He's smiling. And then, of course, our other friend, Kitty Kurth. Now, this will take a second.
Been on the belt, beyond the beltway in every decade since the 1980s.
Nice.
I know you and I have got some status around here.
Yeah.
You've been on every decade. I've been on every decade. I think I am one of just two or three people who's been on in every physical location that this program has ever had. You're one of them.
And you
back
have too.
Back to BEZ.
Yeah, back to Chicago Public Radio, WBEZ, when it was Inside Politics.
Okay. Yep. Yeah.
During the Harold Washington era.
Yep.
Since it is a nationally significant race, let's talk for a second about the Chicago mayoral. Because we've got a national figure in there, Rahm Emanuel, former senior Democrat in the United States House of Representatives, former chief of staff to President Obama, former very high-ranking staff aide to President Clinton. He's now the mayor of the city of Chicago. Many people have said after a term or two as mayor, he might want to try to run for president or do something else.
Nobody that actually knows him thinks that.
I don't doubt that, but many people have said it, and so I'm trying to keep the national listeners interested.
Okay, okay.
Kitty.
Sorry, Chris.
Please help out. Okay. All right, so you are a Democrat. You're close to a lot of these people. We've got a race here that is going on between Emanuel and an activist Democrat member of our Cook County Board, Jesus Chuy Garcia. And Chuy Garcia has been challenging Rahm Emanuel, I think it's fair to say, from the left.
Yes, and I think what's fascinating is so many different national groups have weighed in on both sides. And it's interesting because even though they're both Democrats, Rahm Emanuel and Chuy Garcia, I get many emails from different national groups every day, like accusing Rahm of being part of the 1% and saying that, you know, Chuy is the people's candidate. And it's fascinating to me that it's not so much the candidates themselves that have nationalized the race, but it's the national groups that have wanted to play a role in Chicago politics.
Mm-hmm. Khalil, your view?
There's actually been quite a bit of an outpouring of interest in this race. And the race isn't just about, you know, Chuy or Rahm. The race ultimately is about which trajectory the city of Chicago ought to be taking. And I think it really is, regardless of whether you're for Rahm or Chuy or whoever you're for, whether you're Republican or Democrat, I mean, it really is an interesting race insofar as it's not just about the future of the city. It's ultimately about the future of this country. I mean, think about it. There's issues of education, issues of public unions, issues of crime
pension
and safety,
reform,
issues
reform.
Of pension reform, and so on and so forth. I mean, this truly is a microcosm of the national portrait that I think everybody around the country should be paying attention to, and definitely of 2016, as my friend Kitty says.
Stephanie, your view?
Well, and also it's an issue of who's willing to make the tough decisions. And that's really, I mean, Chicago is one of those cities that is facing huge pension liabilities. And there are significant problems in terms of the city's finances. The bond rating keeps going down, things like that. And so in many ways, although he's a Democrat, Rahm was going to have to take what people might consider more Republican type stances. And he's going to have to make hard decisions. He's had to close schools. He's now being challenged by union ads and things like that. So it really comes down to, and again, it might be a question we look nationally, is who's willing to stand up and take the heat and make those tough decisions and say, forget the political fallout. I have to do what's right.
And how do the voters feel about that?
Right.
You know, and I think the other thing to look at is it was a really small turnout in the first round of elections. And, you know, is it going to be a big turnout? It seems like right now it's going to be a bigger turnout based on early voting. But that also might just be because election day is during spring break.
Yeah. We should point out to listeners around the country that we have a sort of a general primary in which somebody can win outright at 50% plus one. Rahm, as incumbent, was certainly hoping to do that. He did not do that. And so he ended up in this runoff. And now,
technically nonpartisan.
It's
yes,
a technically,
they don't run, technically there's no nonpartisan. Parties here.
And then today a respected poll came out from Tom Swiss here in Chicago, Ogden and Fry pollsters, pegging Rahm support now at 47%, Chuy at about mid-30s, and a good 16, 17% undecided.
Mm-hmm. Which I think, I mean, I'm usually pretty partisan in these matters, and I'm still undecided. I usually have voted by now. When we have early voting in Chicago, and you don't have to, like, give any reason. You can just go and early vote, and I usually go on the first day of early voting because I'm
take
so
care
excited.
Of it. Right.
Because yeah, I'm so excited. But I haven't voted yet. And
well,
I don't know who
well,
I'm voting
what
for.
Happens? I want to ask about the next day for either, because Khalil was pointing out the significance of this nationally as sort of a bellwether or a harbinger.
Yeah.
If Rahm wins, which I think people probably at this point are giving Rahm a slight edge, but you never know. If Rahm wins, Where does he go immediately after with the unions and with the workforce that he's got to run? And on the other hand, if Chewy wins, where is he going to go with the taxpayers? Because he's got a lot of spending programs. And I was saying in the last segment, currently the city of Chicago owes $19,000 per every individual in the city of Chicago. So we don't have a lot of money to throw around.
And I don't have that right now.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have it with me.
Neither does the city of Chicago have it right now.
If I were advising either of them, I would suggest that from both an optics and a political and a governing standpoint, the first thing they should both do is get themselves out talking to people. When Mayor Washington, who was a very divided electorate, and Mayor Washington was our first black mayor, mm-hmm. he knew he had problems talking to the people on the southwest side of the city and on the northwest side of the city.
Which are white ethnic wards.
Which are white ethnic wards and what we call the bungalow belts. So the first thing he did was go out and have town meetings and talk to those people. And it was the smartest thing he ever did, because after they went out and had a dialogue and saw that he was listening and they saw that he was, you know, a regular guy, all of a sudden they figured out, oh, wait, we're just all Chicagoans. We can work on this together. And I think there's got to be a lot of healing.
Well, and that's been part of Rahm Emanuel's problem. He is known nationally for being quite a pit bull. He, you know, the famous dead fish sent to the, you know, the
opposing
political opponents. Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was the one who made all the tough decisions, you know, while Clinton smiled and was, you know, the nice, charming president. Things like that. He's always been sort of the henchman role. And he has, in Chicago, he has maintained that role. And he's always been sort of tough and somewhat unlikable. And that had a lot to do with why people didn't come out and vote for him right away in February. And we saw this because literally, I believe it was 1 or 2 days after that, he came out with what I call the ad of contrition.
Right. Yeah.
And he wore a Mr. Rogers sweater and he sat down and he basically said,
I'm not the
recognizable
guy. Where did he find that sweater?
Mr. Rogers, I'm pretty sure.
Wait a minute.
And he did. He was a complete act of contrition, saying, you know, I'm not the most likable guy. I know it. But I have to make hard decisions.
And it's kind of ironic because he actually is.
No, he's
like,
not.
The
he's
Rahm
not.
That,
no, he's not.
No,
he's
the
not.
Rahm that I have known
there,
since 1987.
There are 14 people who know that Rahm, and that's
he's
it.
A funny,
come on, cut it
he's
out.
A funny,
no.
nice yeah. guy.
Rahm is not a funny and nice guy to 99.999.
And that
he is not.
Well,
and
that is a big problem for
what Chewy needs to do, because we don't.
Chewy Garcia, on the other hand, is the nicest guy anybody in the entire world could ever meet.
But people in half the wards in Chicago still don't know him and haven't
right,
seen him.
Right.
So for either candidate, when they win, again, putting my consultant hat
yes.
on, I would say that each of them need to promise that in the first year they would do a town hall meeting in each of the wards.
Yeah.
They don't have to do it once a week. I'm not saying they have to commit all year to it, but if they do like 3 a week
right.
or 2 a week,
pound them
they
out.
Could get it all done by,
all right,
you know,
but
July.
I want to ask the underlying political question. We got another couple of minutes in this segment, and my underlying political question is this. Is there not tension between, I'm not kidding, because here the fiscal strictures under which Rahm has operated, created by, I think, two very undeniable realities. Mayor Daley, his predecessor, never really got a hand on spending. And number two, Mayor Daley, his predecessor, found out that you cannot raise property taxes. And so he was spending to the extent wanted by the unions,
not
and he was not raising property taxes. Okay. Now, we are getting to a point of conflict where you have the taxpayers and you have the benefit receivers and also all of the employees.
And isn't that in every state around the country?
This
right
is
now,
why I ask what lesson is going to be learned in Chicago? What lesson is at stake in Chicago on this, what I right. consider to be the only domestic issue for 2016?
Well, I was going to say it's going to be cutting spending and the fat where unions are. And I think we saw that with his closing of 50 schools, and that went right to, you know, the teacher situation and the teacher pensions and so on. So I think we will see more of that under Rahm. He's going to look for lots of areas to cut, and a lot of it will be union fat.
And or making the adult decision and saying we have to raise revenues. We've got to raise taxes.
Is that going to get him a lot more friends? Will that make Rahm a lot more friends to say, I'm now going to raise your taxes?
Look, of course not. Again, it's
the reality.
It's going back to the point about optics versus substance. Nobody wants to talk about the substance. Everybody's concerned about what it looks like to talk about raising taxes. And furthermore, you know, as a plea from public union employees is that they're literally losing their Social Security in order to take those public pensions. And at the same time, we're talking about public pensions basically being unfunded and non-existent. That's unfair to public service employees.
We'll talk more about it right after this. It's Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont, Beyond the Beltway.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
It's Beyond the Beltway, and I'm Chris Roebling sitting in for my friend Bruce Dumont, and he'll be back next week right here in this chair. Joining us tonight, we've got Kitty Kurth, Khalil Mirar, and Stephanie Hitt. So we've talked a lot about international relations, and we've talked about some presidential politics. We've even talked about local politics in the city of Chicago, because it does reflect these national issues. It's this question between the government and its beneficiaries and the folks who are paying for it and how much they're willing to pay for it. Let's turn for a second to Washington. Let's turn for a second to Congress and what's going on down there. There is a big development this week. Harry Reid has announced that he's going to end his Senate career. And folks are going to remember Harry Reid based on their view of, you know, his service, obviously. But I wonder at this moment where the Senate is as an institution. The Senate was this counter-majoritarian construct of the founders that was to represent the states. And then 15 years later, that sort of got changed into another democratically elected portion of the legislative branch. But it was still distinguishable because of the 6-year terms and because of the whole rules and traditions that had built up in the Senate. Is the Senate being popularized into a role that is making it a house with longer terms?
I mean, some political analysts say exactly that the Senate, because of exactly what you're talking about, has become perhaps too democratized. But two counter-majoritarian things. One thing you already pointed to, and that is that the states get 2 senators apiece. And the second is that the Senate does not have the kind of high turnover, as you mentioned, that the House does. So it's not entirely, you know, overly democratic, and I think it's still in line with the spirit of what the founders wanted, which is equal representation of every state in the union, first and foremost, and second, longer term, so that senators are not as beholden to public opinion as otherwise would be the case, as in Congress, as rather in the House of Representatives. So I think it's definitely still, even though Congress is not liked, it's definitely still an important function that the Senate carries out that we ought to pay attention to.
Well, in many ways, I know, you know, we have the 3 branches that are supposed to be checks and balances on each other, but now with the Senate and Congress, it's an additional check and balance. It's like an internal legislative check on that balance. And so it makes for some interesting dynamics when you have Republican majority House, but as we had recently, but a Democrat majority Senate. And then all of a sudden, you know, the legislative branch has its own turmoil and its own issues mm-hmm. before you even get, you know, deal with the executive branch or wherever else things go. So it's an interesting dynamic. One of the things that's being discussed a lot with Harry Reid's announcement is has the Senate really just become a polarizing element in politics, mm-hmm. and the leadership of that Senate, mm-hmm. and we saw that a lot with Harry Reid, and whether that's become the way the Senate will be now, and I think that's where a lot of that focus is going to be, is that leadership, and does that work with Congress? Do they work with the executive, or are they just going to become a polarizing faction?
I'm pretty sure if we were to look back at headlines from 20 years ago or 40 years ago or 60 years ago, people would talk about the Senate being too polarizing and too political. I mean, it's a political entity. They're going to be polarizing. It's, you know, this is not news that there's politics in Washington.
Mm-hmm. But wasn't the Senate imbued with a sort of a camaraderie and a club atmosphere of individuals who knew each other for a long period of time? And part of that, and that was reflected
that
in the rules.
Been gone for the last 25 years.
You think so?
I think so. I mean, when
it,
I even
it preceded
when I
li- Harry
when
Reid.
I live, yeah, when I lived there in 92, that was already gone. And a lot of what happened was people flying home more and not staying in D.C. as much. You know, I remember having great conversations with, and I know he had his problems later in his career, but with Chairman Rostenkowski, mm-hmm. about how he and Representative Michael, Bob Michael from Peoria, one very strong Democrat, one a very strong Republican, they used to drive to D.C. every week in a station wagon.
Right.
And they would figure out all the legislation and talk through who can we get to work on this, who can we get to work on that. They knew each other. They knew each other's families. You know, if you hear Cokie Roberts talk about what D.C. was like when her father was there, the whole deal of having people go back to their districts more. I understand it in principle, but in practice, what has happened by having the Congress in D.C. less is it's made the partisanship worse.
And I would say that the parliamentarian element of the Senate, the idea of a popular element in Congress in general, is something that it was really, you know, dying a very slow death. I mean, when you have Congress having such low approval, we have to question why. And maybe it is related to some of the issues that we're talking about tonight. But I would wager money that I think that the partisanship that has taken hold, especially after the Reagan Revolution in this country, and I'm not blaming Reagan, I'm just blaming the punditry, the poison, the toxins of hypersensitized politics in this country, that has basically taken away from the business of government and has really focused energy too much on perception and not enough on the substance.
And that is Professor Khalil Marar from Governor State University, who I thank for joining us on Beyond the Beltway tonight. Also joined by Stephanie Hitt and by Kitty Kurth. Thanks, one. Thanks, all. Beyond the Beltway is a Genebee production, and I want to say thank you also to Dylan Klauke, Colin Bobbitt, and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in getting this program on the air. I'm Chris Roebling. Bruce Dumont's going to be back next week sitting in this chair. And until then, we hope that you're going to have a great week, and we say good night from Chicago.
Good night. Thank you, Chris.
Headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, City Walk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for the new Wild Travels series Saturdays at 5:30 and Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
Sick of wading through social media, papers, and nightly news to get your Chicago political scoop? Subscribe to AlderTrack instead. It's got a weekday newsletter with original reporting on all 50 aldermen, top city agencies, administrative commissions, their staff, and more. It's my go-to source for news, raw data, and council tidbits first thing in the morning. If you subscribe to AlderTrack.com before April 7th, you'll get 10% off. Get AlderTrack now, or you'll be missing out when the new council begins.